The year is 1937. In the heat of the Trinidadian sun, the oil fields are not just pumping crude, they are pumping rage. For decades, the Caribbean has been treated as a private bank for empires, built on the backs of men and women who are paid in pennies and treated like property. But the world is changing. A global depression has tightened the noose around our necks, and the breaking point has finally arrived. From the sugar estates of St. Kitts to the docks of Kingston, the air smells of sweat, burnt cane, and gunpowder. This is not a polite request for a seat at the table. This is a scream for survival. We are looking at a decade where blood was the only currency the colonial office would accept. We are looking at the men and women who stood in front of bayonets so we could finally own our own sweat. But every gain has a price. And in this history, the sacrifice was total. Chapter 1. The Boiling Point. The 1930s did not begin with a bang. They began with a slow, agonizing starvation. While the rest of the world talked about the Great Depression in terms of stock market tickers and bank failures, in our islands, it was measured in the size of a yam and the thickness of a child's ribs. The colonial system was never designed to support us. It was designed to extract from us. When the global markets collapsed, the empires did what they always did. They passed the pain down the line until it reached the person at the very bottom. That person was the Caribbean worker. In January 1935, the island of St. Kitts became the first crack in the dam. Sugar workers at the Buckley's estate asked for a modest increase in wages. They were met with a hard no. The workers did not go back to the fields. They marched. This was the beginning of what we now call the labor rebellions. It was a spontaneous, raw expression of human dignity. The response from the authorities was predictable. They called in the Marines. They opened fire. Three workers were killed, and eight were wounded. The empire thought that would be the end of it. They thought the sight of blood in the dirt would send everyone back to the cane rows. They were wrong. The fire jumped from island to island, like a contagion. By 1937, it reached Trinidad. This was the era of the oil fields. The workers there were seeing the wealth of their land being sucked out of the ground and shipped away while they lived in shacks. Into this tension stepped a man named Uriah "Buzz" Butler. He was a preacher with a silver tongue and a heart full of fire. He spoke a language the workers understood. He did not talk about complex economics. He talked about justice. He talked about the fact that a man should be able to feed his family if he gives his life to the soil. On June 19, 1937, the colonial police tried to arrest Butler while he was addressing a crowd in Faizabad. It was a tactical error that changed history. The crowd did not let them through. A riot broke out. A police officer named Charlie King was chased, beaten, and burned alive. It was a gruesome moment that signaled a point of no return. The authorities responded with warships and battalions. They turned the oil fields into a war zone. Dozens were killed. Hundreds were arrested. But the myth of the silent, obedient worker was dead. In Barbados, the story was the same. Grantley Adams, a highly educated lawyer, found himself caught between his middle-class upbringing and the raw suffering of the people. A young activist named Clement Payne had been stirring the souls of the poor in Bridgetown, telling them they had rights. When the government deported Payne, the city exploded. In July 1937, the people took to the streets with stones and sticks. They were met with the volunteers and the police. 14 people were killed. 47 were wounded. More than 400 were arrested. We have to ask ourselves what it took for a man or a woman to stand in front of a line of armed soldiers with nothing but a rock in their hand. It was not madness. It was the calculated realization that living under these conditions was a slower, more painful death than a bullet. The colonial governors wrote frantic letters back to London. They claimed the unrest was the work of outside agitators or communists. They refused to admit the truth. The system was broken because it was built on a foundation of cruelty. The strikes were not just about money. They were about the right to exist as humans. For the first time, the workers across the Caribbean realized they were not alone. The struggle in St. Kitts was the struggle in Trinidad. The blood spilled in Barbados was the same blood flowing in St. Vincent and St. Lucia. A regional consciousness was forming. A new type of leader was emerging. These were not the elite. These were men who had felt the grit of the earth and the heat of the forge. By the end of 1937, the Caribbean was a powder keg. The authorities had regained control of the streets, but they had lost control of the people. The question was no longer if things would change, but how much more blood would have to be spilled before the empire admitted it could no longer rule by fear alone. The pressure was building, and the next explosion would happen in the largest prize of the British Caribbean. Will the colonial powers break the workers before the workers break the system? Chapter 2: The Cost of the Line. If 1937 was the year of the spark, 1938 was the year of the inferno. The focus shifted to Jamaica. The island was a pressure cooker of unemployment and stagnant wages. At the West Indies Sugar Company in Frome, workers were being paid less than a shilling a day for backbreaking labor. In May 1938, they stopped working. They wanted more. The response was a massacre. Police fired into the crowd, killing four and wounding scores. They burned the huts of the workers. They thought they had crushed the spirit of the rebellion. They had only cleared the stage for Alexander Bustamante. Bustamante was a man of contradictions. He was tall, with a shock of white hair, and a voice that could carry across a harbor. He was a moneylender who became the champion of the penniless. When he heard about the killings at Frome, he did not hide. He went to the waterfront in Kingston. When he stood before the bayonets of the police, opened his shirt, and told them to shoot him if they were going to shoot the workers. It was a moment of theater that became a legend. Bustamante and his cousin Norman Manley represented two sides of the same coin. Manley was the intellectual, the lawyer, the strategist. Bustamante was the street fighter, the man who spoke the language of the dock worker and the sugar cutter. Together, though they would later become rivals, they forced the colonial government to listen. But the government's first instinct was not to listen. It was to lock them up. Bustamante was detained under wartime regulations. They thought that by removing the head, the body of the movement would die. But the movement was no longer just about the leaders, it was about the line. The strike line became a sacred space. And on that line, we saw the true face of sacrifice. We often hear about the men, but we must look at the women. They were the ones who kept the strikes alive. They were the ones who faced down the police while carrying their children. They were the barefoot protesters who marched miles in the dust. In Jamaica, women like Gladys Longbridge, who would later marry Bustamante, worked tirelessly behind the scenes to organize, to feed, and to keep the unions functional while the men were in prison. The trade union became more than an organization for labor. It became a shadow government. It provided a sense of belonging and power to people who had been told for 400 years that they were nothing. The barefoot man was now a man with a vote in his union. This was the real revolution. The colonial office in London finally realized that the Caribbean could not be governed by the old methods. They sent the Moyne Commission to investigate the causes of the unrest. The testimony they heard was a catalogue of horrors. They heard about the filth, the disease, and the absolute hopelessness of the Caribbean poor. The report was so damning that the British government tried to suppress it during the start of World War II. They were afraid it would be used as propaganda by their enemies to show how badly they treated their subjects. But you cannot suppress the hunger of millions. The strikes continued. The agitation continued. The cost was high. Men were blacklisted from work. Families were evicted from plantation housing. Many of the original activists from the 1938 riots disappeared into the prison system or died in poverty, their names lost to history. As the 1940s progressed, the labor movement began to transform. The leaders realized that better wages were only a temporary fix. As long as the colonial government held the keys to the laws, they could always find a way to take back what the workers had gained. The strike had to become a vote. The union had to become a party. This was the moment of the great reversal. The radical energy of the streets was being funneled into the structured world of politics. In Jamaica, the People's National Party and the Jamaica Labour Party were born from this labour strife. In Barbados, the Barbados Labour Party rose from the 1937 riots. The street fighters were putting on suits. They were preparing to negotiate for something much bigger than a few extra pennies a day. They were preparing to negotiate for the islands themselves. But as the leaders moved into boardrooms and legislative councils, a new gap began to open. The workers who had stood on the front lines, who had taken the beatings and the bullets, began to wonder if they were being left behind again. The leaders were gaining power, but were the people gaining freedom? The stakes were shifting from survival to sovereignty. As the body count rises, does the leadership have the stomach to turn labor into a political revolution? Chapter 3. The Heavy Inheritance. By the 1950s and 60s, the transition was complete. The men who had been arrested for sedition and riot were now the ones being invited to London for constitutional conferences. Alexander Bustamante, Grantley Adams, Eric Williams, and Vere Bird. These were the names that would define the era of independence. They had successfully navigated the path from the strike line to the cabinet room. It was a triumph of the labor movement, but it was a triumph with a heavy shadow. When these leaders took power, they inherited a broken house. The colonial powers were leaving, but they were not leaving us with wealth. They were leaving us with the debt of centuries. The new prime ministers found themselves in a desperate position to build schools, hospitals, and roads. They needed investment. To get investment, they needed stability. And to have stability, they often had to suppress the very labor radicalism that had brought them to power in the first place. This is the central tragedy of the post-colonial labor leader. In the 1930s, they were the ones calling for strikes. In the 1960s, they were the ones calling for the strikes to end. They had to balance the demands of the workers with the realities of a global economy that still saw the Caribbean as a place for cheap labor. The fire of the 1930s was being cooled by the pragmatism of governance. We must look at the lives of the workers during this time. The promises of independence were vast. People expected that once the British or the French or the Dutch flags were lowered, the poverty would vanish. It did not. The sacrifice of the original strikers began to feel like a distant memory. In many islands, the trade unions became wings of the political parties. They were no longer independent voices for the workers. They were tools for winning elections. The radical grassroots democracy of the Faizabad riots or the Fromm strikes was being replaced by party discipline. Some leaders, like Uriah Buzz Butler, found themselves sidelined. Butler was a hero of the people, but he was not a man of the establishment. He did not fit into the new polished world of Caribbean politics. He died in 1977, respected as a founding father, but largely ignored by the political machine he helped create. His fate was a symbol of the movement itself. The radical spirit had been institutionalized. However, the legacy of that sacrifice cannot be denied. Because of the blood spilled in the 1930s, we gained the right to vote. We gained the right to a minimum wage. We gained the right to maternity leave and sick pay. These were not gifts. They were won in combat. Every time a Caribbean worker stands up for their rights today, they are standing on the shoulders of the men and women who were mowed down at Buckley's and Frome. The sacrifice of the 1930s was the foundation of our modern identity. It proved that we were not just a collection of islands, but a people with a common cause. It showed that the Caribbean could move as one, but the cost was the loss of that raw, uncompromising fire. As the decades passed, the gap between the leadership and the street widened. The struggle moved from the sugarcane fields to the tourism sector and the financial districts. The question remains for us today. We live in the house that labor built, but is it the house the workers imagined? We have the flags and the anthems. We have the seats in the United Nations. But in the quiet corners of our islands, the ghost of 1938 still walks. It asks if the seat at the table was worth the silence of the streets. It asks if we remember the names of the 14 who died in Bridgetown or the 4 who fell in Jamaica. Our history is not just a list of names in textbooks. It is a record of what we are willing to give up for the sake of the person standing next to us. The labor leaders of the mid-20th century gave up their safety, their freedom, and sometimes their lives. They traded their radicalism for a chance to build a nation. That is an inheritance we carry every day. It is a heavy one. Was the seat at the table worth the silence of the streets?